Dirty Moderates, one of the things that you guys know that I always talk about is the sort of civic ignorance which afflicts this country, the inability of people to step out of their partisan bubbles, to be able to critically think, or even be able to affirm why they believe what they believe. You know, why do liberals believe in an expansive state? What's the reason? You know, other than that's what their parents did, or they loved Barack Obama. You know, similarly, why are conservatives now attached to an idea that, you know, is everything that Reagan and conservatives like that were not? You know, why are they, you know, tethered to this weird sort of big state populism mixed with a kind of social conservatism? All of this is to say that I'm proud to have a guest on today and excited, both proud and excited to have a guest on who I think has done a really superb and I say academic because I think it's just so well researched and well footnoted, you know, look at our founding, what our sort of American political history has been like and where that's taken us ideologically. My guest is John Nance. He is a Stanford man, both undergrad and grad. He's done some really incredible high level consulting. He's, of course, a McKinsey man, because how could you not be? But also Bill Gates Foundation, Johnson & Johnson, and Lyft. And he has set out to write a book that he has titled Rediscovering Republicanism, Renewing America with Our Founding Vision and Values. I want to welcome John Nance to the program. Hi, John.
Hey, Adam. Great to be on with you.
Yeah, no, it's great to talk to you. And I think you've written a very formidable intellectual work. And that's what we need. You know, that's just what people need in this country. But let's just go back to the beginning. Explain why you decided to take a look at rediscovering republicanism. Folks, by the way, it is rediscovering sort of the Republican small r form of government, and why we're a republic is essentially not really a democracy. Oh, we'll get into all that. But obviously, it could also definitely be applied in how can we rediscover big R republicanism. So, John, take us through, you know, your intellectual fermentation and your foundations and how you arrived at this, I think, very, very, very interesting thesis.
Yeah, thanks, Adam.
Sure.
So I come at this from a very different perspective, and you were kind of alluding to that in the biography. I'm a management consultant. I'm not a lawyer. I've consulted for governments, but I haven't worked in governments much. I'm also not a historian. I don't just spend time reading documentation and trying to unpack the past. I actually largely have spent most of my time trying to solve problems. So it was really interesting. I got my graduate degrees, like you said. I studied a lot of like institutions, like why do some institutions work better than other institutions? I did that in college, obviously studied history, took a job at McKinsey, did some work within, you know, larger, some of the companies that you were listing before on a strategy perspective. And I just always had this nagging question. I actually started this work not with an answer, but with a question, which is, you know, I was like, you know, when I was looking at the federal government, I said, there's a lot of really good intentions here. And I'm super confident we need to have a federal government. It's doing some really important things. Yet as I was reading the research, particularly in the economics department where I got my undergrad degree, it didn't seem like a lot of the programs worked very well. And so I was like, that's so interesting because I get hired to solve questions like that. Like, well, you know, I have a company. Like, why is our product not doing well? And you go do some research and you try to figure it out. And so I took a leave of absence from McKinsey. And I said, I really want to figure this out. Like, why isn't it working? And if it's not working that well, what areas aren't working that well? And what else could we do instead? Right? Because it's not helpful to just say this isn't working well, right? The negative Nancy person. It's like, great, well, what's your alternative? Right? Because like sometimes a bad solution is better than no solution.
Right.
Right. And so I came into it very much from a research project perspective. And I spent about a year and a half literally just learning, researching, talking to scholars across the political spectrum, reading different books, being like, but approaching this from a different angle, not from a historian's angle exclusively, but from a very practical, right? What could we do instead? And what's it, what exactly is going wrong here?
Right. And it's interesting because I want this book to get a lot of play, but in our climate, I think people are going to, because everyone's siloed, you know, or actually everyone, too many people are siloed. They're going to read this as kind of a treatise for the right, you know, a kind of conservative small C way of really looking at what the founders intended, you know, how the federal government grew, certainly post Civil War in the 19th century, then exploded in the 20th century. What, you know, progressivism in the realm of Robert La Follette and Upton Sinclair was during the 20th century, and sort of how we got to this big overweening state, which seems wildly out of control. And I'm sympathetic to that. I really am. Your book is interesting because you say, or you imply, that you aren't really trying to retard progress. You're not saying let's rewind all the good accomplishments that have been made, but it seems to say that, you know, from where we started, from this small idea that we're 13 states then, but that we're this large country, and that the closer we are to our government, the closer to our states and localities, the better off we are. Maybe the more innovative it is. You know, you bring a consulting management problem solving focus. So how do we make our system of governance more dynamic? Right. Tell me how you balance it. And I like this, but with the size of government and all that it does and the amount that we spend on debt because of these social programs and that, you know, where do you begin? Because it sounds like there would be some pain involved here, some fiscal pain, both for how the government operates and how people receive things that they've grown very, very accustomed to. Let's go into that a little bit.
Yeah, totally. And Adam, I appreciate your recapitulation of American history that you did so elegantly in 3 minutes. You pretty much nailed it.
Thank you.
I will generally answer your questions, but let me do one direct, really quickly at the beginning, because I want to talk about why I think this matters at a very high level. At a very high level, and it gets to the title of the book, which is, you were mentioning republicanism, and that we live in a republic.
Yeah.
And what I want people to know is that this is a debate and an issue worth really thinking about. And here's why. If you look at, and I'm talking about not American history, I'm talking about human history.
Yep.
Okay. And if you look at human history, we have the first written constitution in the modern era. There's a little bit hilariously, there was a written constitution in Corsica.
Napoleon's birthplace. Right.
But let's call it of an existent country. Okay. We are the first written constitution, right? In the modern era, we have the first written Bill of Rights that was applicable to all citizens. So you had certain things like Magna Carta in England, but if you actually read it, it was like certain prerogatives for nobles.
Yep.
Right? The Bill of Rights, obviously, if you read it, it applies to all of us. That was a first in human history as well.
Right.
And we're the first government to really have what we call federalism, where we actually had empowered local governments that had certain powers that the federal government actually didn't have. So you actually had local subsidiary institutions with a broader set of powers than the central institution. That was the first time in human history.
Yeah. And it's etched in the Bill of Rights, this 10th Amendment.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. It doesn't have a lot of teeth right now, but the concept has been in the 10th. Okay.
Yeah.
So first written constitution.
Okay.
First Bill of Rights. Now let's look at the world today.
All right.
India has a constitution. Iraq has a constitution. Germany has a constitution. Over 120 countries have written constitutions now, functioning democracies, liberal democracies. Most of them have bills of rights. Many of them have the subsidiary concept. So in 1,000 years, and I hope it's human civilization, we are a part of an experiment that really matters. So as we debate this as Americans, I think it's really important that we understand the role that we're playing in human history. Like, we kicked off this massively important experiment in self-government.
Yep. The oldest continuous self-government the world's ever known, right?
Yes.
As of this conversation, right?
Yes. And so I just want people to know, and, you know, we have to get the brass tacks of this, and we can talk, you know, politics gets really muddy and nasty and all this stuff. But if you pull away from the details, the sordidness of the day-to-day, we are part of a really special experiment. And as I wrote this book, I really take that perspective. I just want people to know that we're part of a republic. We're the first modern republic. We've inspired the world to adopt this form of government. Obviously, people have modified it, revised it, and we can learn from them too. Mm-hmm. But I just want people to know that this with the conversation we're having and the debate we're having, it really matters.
I think it's great. I mean, you're you know, describing in so many words sort of one of my, I don't want to say my mantras, but one of the things I also remind people about and why this podcast was created, to fight on behalf of, you know, we say saving democracy one episode at a time. Maybe we should be saving the republic one episode at a time. But regardless, what you're essentially saying is America itself is an idea. It's not a person. It's not an ideology. It's an idea. And that idea has been the inspiration for this unique way of trying to govern a free and fair society. Right. And using, you know, predicated on concepts like liberty and equality that had to grow alongside a society that's grown, but that there's this idea of America that we are fighting for, right? The idea that self-government exists, right? That the government is not our boss. We are the government. So if the government isn't doing what we want, they're not, that's not an effective government. You know what I mean? We don't need to answer to government. I said this about several months ago. So I was doing a thing on like negative liberty, you know, the whole idea of what we are. We are not protected by government as a design in this country. We're protected from government. And that's pretty unique too, you know, because that's, and so your book starts to go into obviously, you know, the failures of the war on poverty, so much that went wrong in the Great Society, the looming insolvency of things like Medicare, Social Security, which you talk about, and the way in which that we haven't even made, but for a few times, and I will get into that, any real effort in our modern era to say, hey, you know, our government is not there to be like a benevolent giver. It's there to give you the freedom to do the things that you want to do, right? And hopefully there's a government closer to you, meaning in your town, that can guide you. But this Leviathan isn't supposed to be running your life. And, you know, where we are, your book basically argues we've gone so far astray from our founding that it's almost as if it's incompatible, right, where we are with what the idea of America is. Would you say that that's a fair reading of your book?
Well,
a sort of fair theme of your book might be.
I think a lot of what you're saying is very fair. I'm really surprised by this. I would probably characterize it as slightly more optimistic, with a slightly more optimistic tone.
Okay.
There are a few really important things you said. I want to go back and pick up on them.
Sure.
One thing that you said that is fundamentally important, and this is actually because you've got the liberty democracy debate. I mean, you really can kind of boil things down like. This is kind of the thing we've been debating for a while. And there's books been written just about this debate. But there's an assumption below both of those that you just said. And I want to make sure your listeners really understand this. We are government of, by, and for the people. Mm-hmm. That was a radical idea. Mm-hmm. And I'll explain this to people. If you go back into the 1700s, 1800s, even 1900s, one of the common things that you would hear is you would say, I am the subject of the king. Like right. You read the literature and it's one of those things where you just sort of, you know, you watch John Adams and you're just listening. You're like, yeah, whatever. That's kind of a cute language, but take a second and think about that subject. It's very clear. The king is up here and you are his subject. Mm-hmm. You will do what he says. He will cancel laws. He will veto. He will do all these. And this is the English king, who was probably the most limited king. I mean, you go to Russia, you go to Germany. I mean, the king was like all powerful.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Sure.
So under the Constitution, under the Bill of Rights, was exactly what you just said, that in our government, it was of, by, and for the people, and all political power, and this was said by multiple thinkers and politicians in the founding era, all political power resides in the people. Mm-hmm. And we, through the Constitution, give some of our powers to the government. The government, the federal government, and our state constitutions, right? And that's why we had, if you go back and look procedurally what happened, the Americans would convene to ratify the Constitution, which was they're saying, yep, we approve this. We're giving away these powers so you could do certain things for us, but we're not giving away everything else. And we did the same thing with our state constitutions. That's a hugely important point because it's what you said is exactly right. That the American people ultimately are the repository of all powers. We delegate powers. And that's why the written Constitution, and I'm more traditional in my constitutional jurisprudence here personally, because if you start interpreting the Constitution more liberally, like, well, I think it means this. It doesn't say that, but it would be nice if it said this. A lot of times I agree with the conclusion, but you're undermining this fundamental point of the people get to decide what powers, not unelected judges, right? Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to say that what you said there is really, really important. The philosophy of the American experiment is that American citizens, we ultimately, collectively and individually, we hold all power. And then we decide which powers to delegate via the constitutions. And then the government, we elect certain politicians to go manage that power for a certain period of time. And then they come back to the, then they come back to the public. So, and it's associated with the role, not the person. That was another big innovation that we had. So anyways, I know we kind of went down that digression, but that's so important.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we get to decide which things do we decide on our own?
Mm-hmm.
And which things do we decide collectively? And it's, let me, another example on this.
Sure.
Because sometimes I think we just, when I was writing the book, it's like this. It's the things that societies assume that define right. you the most.
Okay.
People think it's what you debate. It's not what you debate.
Mm-mm.
It's what you're all assuming.
Right. Interesting. Yeah.
That's, if you look historically, that's what makes a society interesting. What debate, that's what we think's interesting. But historians aren't going to find it interesting. What they're going to find interesting is what we're not debating, what we're all assuming. And let me give you an example.
Okay.
No one's going to, the federal government's never going to pass a law and saying men have to wear green shirts on Wednesday.
No. Let's hope not. Right.
But that's but there are certain governments in human society, human yeah. history, have told people what they have to wear. But yeah. you can be on the far left, you can be as woke as you want, and you can be extremely conservative socially, economically, whatever. I don't think anyone's going to agree. Maybe you'll find a few crazies that would want to have laws about what people can wear. But that's interesting because the ancient Greeks would do that.
Right.
So what's that about? That's because we all agree, we don't realize it, but we all agree that fundamentally we're the sovereigns of our own lives. And we haven't yeah. given over the power of what we wear, who we date, who right. we marry, how many right. kids we have. We all assume that that's up to us, right?
Right.
But that's huge. And I think yeah. it's really important that people remember that and we appreciate that regardless of our political persuasions. And we can debate tax rates and domestic policy and all this stuff. But let's not forget that there's a lot that we all agree on.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean,
is this helpful, Adam? I know I'm kind of jumping around
here. No. It's great. It's great. I mean, it's all food for thought. We're, you know, we're going to have by definition a digressive discussion because there's a lot swirling here. I think that one of the interesting things is in choosing a government, unlike in say the founders and in how we created this idea of America, you know, we it was modeled right on ancient Rome and the Enlightenment philosophies, basically. It was not based on the city states of Athens or Sparta, you know, where people went to the town square. That's not what it is, you know, but fundamental to small r representative government is we were choosing people, right, as our emissaries. We're still in charge, but we send them to Washington to represent us. And I think what has partially happened here, and you talked about, you know, what people assume and how people think we live. Your book does something also that I love. You talk a lot about all, basically the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of a corollary to what you just said in the sense that, you know, we all assume that, well, we have to do these things because this is what we do, you know. And the problem with that is we don't know collectively what we're supposed to do. We don't understand the functioning of our government. So we try to the government has settled into, I call it this horrible slouch. It bothers me terribly of, we have a problem, let's legislate it. We need this, let's pass a law. I live in California. It's an abomination, the amount of law. Now it is a state. It never stops. I mean, from the parking thing to the garbage, there is literally nothing that can be left alone. I think this largely is the fault of the Democrats, but as of late, the Republicans seem to want to weaponize the state against people's personal lives. So they're just as guilty. Again, I'm not a member of either party. That's what I'm a dirty moderate. But this idea that, there's an ill in society, let's pass a law. Because my issue with it, and I think your book tackles a lot of it, apart from laying out the intellectual history, you'd got to take account for human nature, right? You can't socially engineer people to be good. It's been a real problem. You just can't. You know, there's all these books on psychology of like why diversity training now isn't working, because you go in and you say, you bad, you are a racist. And everyone's like, how is this making me more under? Now I'm kind of pissed off at you because I'm actually not. And now I resent my colleague. You know, it has the opposite effect because you're trying to superimpose a way of thinking and feeling on a human being. You see where I'm going with this? So what I mean is that it's easy to say we're going to have a war on poverty. Great. We're going to cure poverty. But when put into effect, it's bureaucracy. It's bureaucrats. It's money spent. It's government run amok. It's things that, yeah, you can say, well, it fed certain people and did certain things, but it literally hasn't accomplished what it's supposed to. And it's bleeding the treasury, you know, and it's governing from afar. It's not letting the state of Missouri do what they need to do, right? It's giving a one size fits all approach. And, you know, in Republican, small R Republican virtue, I think, which is so predicated on the idea that you are trusting the people because we, the people, are the rulers, is now in the hands of bureaucrats and corrupt politicians. Problem is, even the quote unquote small R Republicans who go to Congress, they're doing a big government kind of bidding, whether it's through the defense industry, through lobbying, through, right? I mean, it's all become uncontrollable. It's what people want to spend money on, what they want to spend. The point is to say that, you know, we'd have to have this is a radical book, because you'd have to go back and you'd have to reorient the way we live now.
Absolutely. Well, let me, Adam, if you don't mind, I'll say two things.
Sure. Yeah.
So my book basically has, you know, three sections.
Yeah.
Three big sections.
Yep.
And one of the contributions I make, and it is a little bit, and I'll be honest, it's not the easiest book to read. And I tried to make it easy, but I was like, I thought it was very clear
meaning, because it feels like an academic book, but it doesn't have jargon. Right. Like our graduate school books are written, and you're right. Like, well, this is such bad writing. No, this is, I thought it was very clear, very well cited and sourced, which is always the key. So someone could say, where does he get that from? But no, well, look at, you know, which a lot of people don't realize, those books are written often without footnotes. So you don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, go ahead.
Right. No, totally. Well, I wanted to say one of the things that I think my book does that I think is new, and I've obviously, people have, you know, a number of people have read the book. I've gotten a lot of conversations about it, but it's all, you know, I think it's important as an author to know what's a contribution I've made.
Right.
And so the middle section of the book,
yep,
is all about saying, and it's, this is building on what you were saying, the things that aren't going wrong, why? And, you know, and what I was trying to do there was like root cause analysis. Like, right, let's really, 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 really get into the weeds of this. And I have three very simple terms that I coined as I was writing this book to kind of encapsulate. And I'll quickly tick through them.
Sure.
So what you were referring to on the social program side, what I call is complexity failure.
Yeah.
And what that basically means is take a issue like poverty. Right. And I think all of us know people who are in poverty. Right. I have people in my family that technically are in poverty. Right. Mm. From a financial perspective, how much they earn, they're in poverty. They're all completely different. Right. I have one, you know, I might have one person who just was down on their luck. One person maybe had a kid, you know, in unfortunate circumstances. One person has an alcohol problem. Right. One person doesn't want to work. I'm just saying theoretically. These are completely different people. And by the way, one person can change over their lifetime. You can't just say, well, John doesn't want to work. I might not want to work, but in 3 years, maybe my situation changes. Right. So the point is extremely complex.
Very.
So I think where we went wrong, where we went right as a country, by the way, we are the latest figures that I saw, we had spent the highest percentage of our GDP on charity in the world. Mm-hmm. In the world, I don't know, maybe Vatican City's higher, but at least from the data that I saw, right, substantial countries, it's around 3% of GDP, which, by the way, is about as much as we spend on social programs. Because people always say, oh, charity can't solve problems. I'm like, we spend as much money on charity as we spend on all these other programs, by the way, dollar for dollar. So it's not like massively different, right? I've heard people, I mean, just so everyone knows the basic facts, it's 3%. Yeah. Okay. The problem, I think, is, but it's like, I get it. It's like, yeah, take some money from my paycheck, right? Go to the federal government, help. They can help poor people. I don't want to worry about this. Like, let them do it. Like, let's just outsource this. I don't want to have any moral qualms on my hands. Right. Okay. Here's the problem. You said it, but I just want to make
it. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the federal government. What are they going to go do? Okay. Let's just walk. So everyone is clear what they're going to go do. So they're going to say something really nice on the campaign trail. They're going to pass a law that's 600 pages long. And in that law, it empowers them to go hire a bunch of people, right? And I don't know people who know people in Washington, D.C., but they tend to not be the most entrepreneurial people. It's like,
no, I worked at, yes, it's you are working as, there's something to be said for the government job, right? Yeah. It's steady. It's but steady, and has a lot of time off, and you're guaranteed a pension, but it isn't what I would call dynamic.
No, right. Okay, but no, it's yeah. not. But let's right. but let's not forget that point.
Right.
You go hire a bunch of these people that yeah. are probably part of federal unions, so they stop working at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
They're going to go make a bunch of rules, a bunch of forms, a bunch of processes, because that's how governments work. You don't get to just, you know, the government can get sued if they treat different people differently. And we're going to give these people and that institution the problem of individual cases of poverty. I mean, the idea that that institution is going to be right. effective with one of the most, I mean, building a business is hard, but it's pretty straightforward.
Oh yeah.
Solving someone
except for the fact, I say this having been in business my whole life, when yeah. you have skin in the game, and you probably know this, it's a whole different thing. You're not going to write a 600 page document of nothingness, which bears no responsibility to anybody, and go home and go out to lunch, because there are real world consequences. You know, there is a real chasm, if you will, between bureaucracy and the bureaucrats who run it and real life. Because rules can be made. Their job is to make the rules. Like you said, 4 o'clock. Okay, Bob, we're going for a drink. That's it. You're out of there. They have no obligation, as long as it's per the executive branch's rules, right? And it is commensurate with laws made by Congress.
Right.
Bye. I mean, you know, yeah. that's it.
Right.
You know, there's no incentivizing here. It's not. Totally. It's not. Right.
Well, actually, the screwed up thing is there is an incentive. It's actually an incentive to have more poor people and to have the poor people.
Well, that's true. Yes.
Stay there longer, because that's how I have a job.
Yeah.
But I think most people don't get caught up in that. But that is the incentive. But here's the. But let me know. If we just stay back. It's like, okay, wait. So we have a bunch of rules, a bunch of paperwork, a bunch of bureaucrats who work 9 to 5 p.m. and we've asked them to go solve the most intransigent human problem in human civilization.
Right.
And we think that's going. Well, what a nice idea.
Right.
Right. But then in the book, I say, you have to sit here and be a little bit responsible as a citizen and say, okay, great. I get it. That's well-intentioned.
Yeah.
What were the results? And the results are exactly what you would expect.
Yeah.
We have, and I have all these stories in the book. And I think what's one of the things I like about the book is there's a lot of meaty examples of where things go wrong, where you have someone who can barely read, has to fill out a form. She's being abused. The caseworker doesn't care. Right, you have poverty rates going up. You have out of wedlock rates going up. Well, why is that? Because if I get married, I lose my government benefits. So I'm living with my person, but I don't want to get married because then I lose my benefits. Oh, unintended consequence.
Sure.
How long did it take the bureaucracy to figure that out? They didn't even figure it out. They just keep sending out.
They the just floor. No. They keep doing the same thing over and over. Right.
It's not a learning.
It's not adaptive. It's not adaptive.
It's adaptive over decades.
Decades. Right? Yeah.
So what you and I would figure out in a week. And a nonprofit like a church or a synagogue or a, you know, Salvation Army would figure out in a year.
Right.
Right. Or a state government might figure out in 5 years.
Right.
The federal government takes them 30 years to figure out.
Right.
This is a mess. And that's why I'm like, so a subject is complexity failure. We shouldn't be giving them complex problems. It's like giving a computer like, hey, can you solve, tell me where to go for, what's the favorite vacation I'm going to have? It can't answer that question.
Can't answer that. Right.
But we made a mistake as citizens. Because we want to help the most needy in our society, which I agree with that impulse. Give to charity myself. I think it's really important. But we deluded ourselves into thinking that this institution, and I'm saying my the point of my book is that's not going to change. That is a fundamental.
Yep.
It is a it's a flaw. It's an issue that's not going to go away. So at some point we'll wake up and then my book, and then it's like, okay, great. That's the problem. What do you go do? Well, let's talk about what we did before we tried this experiment. It's not like American history started in 1965.
No, right.
We had state governments did stuff for poor people from the beginning. We've had the Scots and Irish Charity Foundation was, I think, created in 1650 in New York City.
Yep.
We know exactly what we're going to do with poor people in this country. In fact, the poverty rate in the United States, I guess nobody knows this, was around over 65% in 1900. It went all the way down to 11%.
Hmm.
So it's like, well, what happened when we didn't have the federal government involved? We have the answer to that question. Poverty went down 80%. What's happened since? It's higher. I mean, this is not complicated.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think you the other issue. No, it's the complexity of problems with a top-down approach. You talk a lot about that in the book. Is ridiculous. There's, you know, Washington D.C. setting the laws for, you said you named five people in your family or whatever. We're a nation of 330 million people, right? And quite frankly, you know, that what Terre Haute, Indiana needs has nothing to do with what Helena, Montana needs or New York City needs. You know, I've always said, and you know, I have so many friends way to the left of me. I mean, I guess I'm center right, I would say. And they, you know, they're so addicted to the federal government passing laws. And I'll say to them, and they're not against it, they never thought of it. I said, what business does Washington, D.C. have telling a cattle rancher in Montana what they should charge? And you under, and so when you say, why are they these places voting again? Well, because what Montana, if you've never lived in Montana, how, I mean, just, it's like understanding someone else's shoes. They can do that. If you said, it's interesting the way human psychology works. If you said, you know, a poor person, you know, needs a lift up from that, they go, oh yes, yes, yes. Government needs to do that. But if you say, why are you regulating that? They go, huh? Well, yeah, well, I mean, but with the government, and they go, no. This is why they're voting against you. You have no right to do it. You're in their business. They are on, let them, right? Let them on the, in Big Sky Country, let them on the Great Plains decide what to do with the bison. It has nothing to do with you. Mm-hmm. It's nothing to do with me. I live in LA. I'm in New Jersey right now. What does that have to do with me? And it's just, they are, on a, like a list, like a grocery list of things. We need eggs, we need milk, you know, federal government does that. We need this, we need to regulate. We got ranchers fees, we got interstate highway, we got, so that, right? So everything, like you said, becomes rote, and bureaucracy and government are by definition sclerotic, right? So brush that up against the idea that you have a dynamic changing people in a huge society, right? And you have a government which, unlike the free market, really isn't designed to adapt. Or if, like you said, if the federal government adapts, it comes way, way later and the program is bigger than it ever is. It's almost like, it's almost impossible to untangle without major political repercussions, which politicians don't want to risk.
Totally.
You know?
And one thing I want to say that I, if you don't mind me just building on what you're making that I really like there, is that, and I talk about this in the book, I'm not recommending, having spent a lot of time research this, and I think coming at it from a somewhat similar perspective as you, that we don't do anything for the, let's take the example we're talking about, our most needy citizens. I literally, I can boil down my recommendation. It's like, we have 50 states. The people who are struggling in these states are different. There's different companies around, there's different opportunities around, there's different substance abuse problems around. I mean, you just said, I mean, Helena is not the same as New York City, is not the same as Austin, Texas, not the same as San Jose. And it's ridiculous to think we are. So right. All I'm saying is, hey, we've run an experiment since 1965 with the federal government taking the lead on helping the most vulnerable people in our civilization. The data has come in. It's not good. Why? Complexity failure, right? It's a bureaucracy. There's a complex problem. They weren't set up for success. We tried. There's nothing wrong with trying, but you got to wake up and say it's not working. What do we do? Let's go back to the thing that was working before. And we need our state governments, our local institutions,
yep,
to take on the primary responsibility of taking care of our most needy people so that we can customize and tailor the support to the person and to the local environment that they're in. So I just want everyone to be clear. It's not like, because I think sometimes we get these false dichotomies. It's like,
that's because of the climate we're in, not because of what you're arguing. People right. will automatically put you in the right wing camp. Look, listen, I've heard from both. Some people say, wow, you are just so conservative, it makes me sick. And other people call me a radical lefty. So I know I'm doing something right, right? That's the way I look at it.
That's good.
But yeah,
I just want people to know that there is another option. And I do think ideas, change starts with ideas, right? It's like, I understand we got to get everyone on board, but like, this takes decades. I'm part of a decades long project. I'm in no rush.
Right.
I know exactly how this stuff plays out. And I just want people to know that there are really good ideas. And the idea here is we return to federalism. And I talk in the book a little bit about the reason we got away from the reason state governments are actually pretty high functioning relative to the federal government. This is a very clear, you can look at a bunch of different indices, right? No surprise by that, right? It's much more responsive. It's much more local democracy. So why do we move away from this? And I'll tell people the answer. The reason is because, there's a historical reason, is because of slavery and discrimination. Full stop, period. We never would have centralized these programs.
No.
Except for we fought a civil war because we had certain states that didn't want to stop enslaving people. And then we had the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act in 1964 and 1965. Guess when social welfare programs passed, by the way? Same year.
That's not
a coincidence.
Yep. It's all the LBJ era. Sure. Roosevelt was Social Security, but LBJ had the lion's share of it. Right.
Yeah. And just the social welfare part.
Yeah.
So, and so people didn't trust the state governments because they were, and by the way, this is true. This isn't a left-wing talking point. Just for people who are more right-wing, I think it's important to be honest with your history. The state governments were absolutely discriminating as part of their social welfare programs. And you had multiple states in the South where it's like, oh, it's the winter, we'll give you on the dole, and the spring we'll take it away, so you have to go work on the plantations.
Right.
I mean, I have no interest in that.
No, the federal government had to equalize it. Let me add one thing, though. In the 20th century, the other thing that I think inarguably has to be said for why the government expanded was the Great Depression and World War II. So Roosevelt used the, we had 25% unemployment, banks closed, people in food lines, horrible. You know, we have never experienced that again. You know, it became, well, the government's going to come in and save you. And then it became foundational to current, which would foundational to what is now current liberal Democrat, not classical liberal, but liberal left wing kind of ideas. You write about the migration of ideas from Europe, which even came over in the 19th century, the idea that there's a statist example of how to live, you know, sort of cradle to grave Scandinavian style. But actually, on a digression, it's very interesting. People don't really understand Norway and Sweden and all that. Those countries tried much stricter versions of socialism that failed. It's really capitalism and the income like that Norway gets from oil, for example, that fuel their ability to have, they're also homogeneous and small, this kind of like perfect society, but there's a private option for everything. You know, everybody talks about, I mean, what I mean is it's not all state run. It sounds like it is, but plenty of people opt to do the things to have a private choice. So it's, which suggests to me, even they know, right, that, you know, a model whereby the government does everything as from a top down has its limits. You know, and listen, there's limits to hope. Let's face it. Someone asked me once, why are you not, or why did you leave the Democratic Party, and what informs small C conservative principles? This is relevant to this. And I said, I'll tell you why. I said, and I always had it, even when I was, you know, a registered Democrat. Again, human nature. Humans are greedy. They're selfish. They're all, in so many ways, that is just intrinsic to humanity. Can you mitigate it? You can mitigate ideas with good laws. And like, as you argue, state and localities trying to help, but you can't fundamentally change. That's why communism failed. You can't have 17 people working and one guy makes all the money. And say, well, you got to share. It's just, it's not real. Humans will be greedy. Humans will want more. And also it's a sort of dim view of human nature, but at the same time, I don't like social engineering for that point. So again, you know, being kind of sympathetic initially to the idea or through my life of sort of what the government did to help people, you do have to take a gimlet eye. You do have to take a scalpel and, you know, not an axe, but a scalpel and go, let's really go through this. And, you know, we really got to figure out what are we doing? And certainly, I mean, the national debt is like $31 trillion. And I always say neither party cares. I mean, at what point do we stop spending? Like, at what point? I remember when, like, you know, $3 trillion was a lot of money. We're 10 times that. I remember, you know, it's like, so everyone says, yeah, we're passing another bill. The small C conservative me goes, so at some point, you just keep borrowing. I get it. We're borrowing from China. I understand. We have a credit card. You just do that indefinitely? And it's run amok, as I said. It's just program after program after expansion after expansion. At some point, there isn't even a discussion, John, for the most part, that the biggest thing should ever be discussed as just state issues anymore. I mean, it's always what the federal government does. Yes, states rely on the federal government for money, and they all have their self-governments. But really, when you want to get something big done, right, it's the feds. I'm not arguing that's good, but it is the feds.
Right now.
Right.
And I think what I want, in the book, and I think we said Rediscovering Republicanism is the title for those who want to check it out.
Yeah.
Look, American history changes. And I talk about this in the book, right? So before the Civil War, there's kind of these three big phases of U.S. history. If you just look at where the money's being spent,
right.
Phase one is the founding. So 1789 through 1861,
right.
The state governments actually spent more than local governments and the federal government combined.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't know this. It kind of depends on where you call it, but let's just call it like after Reconstruction. So it's called 1880 to 1932.
Okay.
Actually, local governments spent more than state governments and the federal government. We're talking about counties and cities. This was the big machine politicians.
Yep.
Right. A lot was happening at the local level. People don't know this, but it was but if you think about it, it's like machine politicians and all this, that was happening at the local level. And in 1932 to today has been the federal driven model, right? Where the federal government spends more local. Here's my point. It's really important people understand it. We're not stuck in this way. Mm-hmm. We're not stuck in this way of doing things. We can absolutely change it. And I think at this point, the data is so clear. I think it's just a matter of time.
Mm.
And I think it's going to be a revolution of sorts, democratic, of course. But I think it should be. And I think at some point we're going to say, this is not working. And we got to do this root and branch. And we got to take, and I talk about this in the book. I mean, my recommendation is very simple. Take all the social welfare programs, all of them. They're trying to help indigent people. And send it to the state governments, right? Have some controls. You can't discriminate, right? If someone's in dire poverty, you don't get to not give them any money, right? I'm looking at you, some people in the South that like are very stingy.
Yeah.
You have to give them some money, right? Basic rules in place, right? Because some people are like, just let them figure it out. It's like
No. That's what I'm saying. You're being realistic about it. Pragmatic is the word.
But I mean, that's possible, right? It's called block granting. I mean, if we get majorities, like big majorities, and I'm not saying how it'll happen, but if it does happen, if we get a consensus as the public, hey, this isn't working, we want to send it to the states aren't discriminating anymore. I'm sorry, that just isn't happening, right? We have laws against it. We have a federal judiciary against it. So the reason we federalized this in the first place, which was basically racism and slavery and discrimination, has basically been wiped out in the public arena. I'm not saying it doesn't happen.
No.
Citizens, but I'm saying, let's be real here. The state governments really aren't doing that all too often.
Yes, we're not in the Jim Crow era anymore.
We're not in the Jim Crow era. I'm sorry. I know some people love the whole
That's another argument that people, liked it. Yeah, anyway, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a thing, but it's not a thing now, right? So you got to update your priors.
Right.
and I think you update your priors. And I think once you do all of that and you look at the evidence of these programs results, like I talked to Tavis Smiley, the pretty left-wing guy on CNN. I was on his show and I brought this up to him and I walked him through and he said, I think you make a fair point.
Yeah.
And that's Tavis Smiley. I mean, he's not exactly a center guy. And I walked him through it and he said, you make a fair point, because I said, look, I'm not saying we don't do anything. I'm saying who does it?
Right.
And I think the state governments, they're so much more innovative. And we all know that. They're much more. There's 50 of them.
50 of them.
50 different, but Louis Brandeis.
You mentioned the famous Louis Brandeis, the laboratories of democracy.
Exactly. And he's a very left-wing progressive.
Yeah.
Some progressive would debate that, but he's a pretty left-wing guy. He wasn't a conservative.
No.
And even he was like, hey, and just to learn from a learning mindset, do you want one institution doing something? That's not A-B testing. Okay. FYI on basic testing protocols. But if we have 50 different places, no one knows what's going to work. Let's let 50 different places try and we can learn from each other. And it's not like racism is just going to, happen again.
Well, and you said the word.
That's where we're headed, by the way. I think we're going to get there. I think it might take 50 years, but I think the current model is so
broken.
And I think a lot of the core constituencies historically that have supported these programs, and you look at African Americans, you look at Hispanics, and you look at their voting profiles.
Oh, yeah.
Younger generations, they're not far left. I mean, and so.
Well, that also speaks to the ill health and the decrepit nature of our two-party system, because what I mean by that is I had on on the program, I had on an African American political strategist, and I said to her, any free market ideas? I mean, it seemed a little tethered. And you know what she said? I'm as free market. She said, I'm a first-class entrepreneur. She goes, the majority of the African American community is. We just don't want to vote for a party that propagates white supremacy. And that's true. What MAGA and the Republicans do is they do race bait. And you have to, and I understand that. So they don't love, you know, the black middle class and black upper class are huge. You never hear, but they're huge. They don't necessarily want the overweening size of the state, but they're voting because, like you said, race is so intertwined with the size and scope of the federal government that we're now at a time where de jure segregation is well behind us. Institutionalized racism remains a fight, but let 50 states go out there, not about racism, but discuss how to solve the more basic problems. I want to point out what you wrote in the book because I lived through and I loved Bill Clinton. I thought he was a great president, and you took a, you took the opportunity to remind people. I mean, I guess we both lived through it. I don't know how old you are, but I was in college. Bill Clinton ran famously in 1992 as a new kind of Democrat. He said he'd fight for the forgotten middle class, and he said we would, quote, end welfare as we know it. And you write about this. And when it came time, in 1996, which was a re-election year, but remember, a Republican Congress had come in, and they deserve some credit for this too. But Bill Clinton finally had an opportunity to end the aid to families with dependent children, the AFDC, which was the federal guarantee of public assistance, so that we could try something else because welfare had become out of control. Some of it was overly stigmatized, but people just thought, especially since the 70s and into the 80s when wages started to stagnate, hey, you're a working class guy. People can go the dole. They can collect a check. You know, it wasn't about black or white. It was literally about, why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. And Bill Clinton said, let's block grant it. Like you said, let's let the states try it. Let's impose some work requirements. Let's make sure that we don't just have compassion. We've got compassion and we've got tough love. Let's try it. And I think you mentioned Wisconsin and some other states in all, you know, varied forms of experimentation, went ahead and did that. And look, you know, there were outcries at the time, screams by the senators and resignations in the Health and Human Services Department of the Clinton administration. Marion Edelman, a famous Clinton ally, said this is going to kid somebody. I don't remember who it was. The children are going to be sleeping on cold, snowy nights on grates, you know, and that kind of thing. Turns out that it created a more self-actualizing, a more self-realizing underclass that, and I don't know all the numbers, but that people just reacted. Because if they know that's there, they're going to take it. If you say, hey, listen, you got to do X, Y, and Z. Psychologically, there are people who probably have been mired in a way of thinking and thought, wait a second. And then they work and then they work more and then they get out of it because they go, well, yeah, I could have subsisted on the dole. But now this gave me a real leg up. You know what I mean? That actually is almost a bootstrap pulling policy.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And I mean, look, I mean, that's probably one of the most important policy examples we have last 30 years, and people don't like to talk about it.
Well, you never hear about it anymore.
Particularly on the left. And I don't know why the right doesn't talk about it more, but sometimes I'm not sure there's...
Well, but the reason... Okay, this is the thing. You see, you're a problem solver. I'm a dirty... I actually consider myself a problem solver. I was never a consultant. Yeah. But it's like, we're not tethered to party ideologies. We're not writing platforms. You're not here to hawk for the Democrats, me the Republicans, vice versa. The reason is that Bill Clinton is the Democrat, even though he was so popular and won the country. He had a big, you know, bit more states... But now there would be won so many red states, you know, in those days, because it would be giving credit to the other side, even though the Republicans had Congress. You know, everything is delineated and demarcated in a partisan way, and it's destructive. Yeah. And add in corruption, add in lobbying, add in the defense industry, feeding off the Leviathan that's the government, and you see why people don't want to shrink the government.
Yeah.
Not because the people don't want it, but the people in power don't want it. And that's human nature too. Power corrupt, absolute power corrupts absolutely, Lord Acton said, and that's the truth, you know.
Well, yeah, and let's, I mean, if you don't, I can just give you a few more fact points on what you said. I mean, on the welfare reform, just for listeners. It was fascinating. So nationwide, and people, by the way, you can look this up on Google, right? Don't take my word for it. Just type in AFDC case count. And go into Google and Google Images, and you can look at yourself.
And by the way, let me add it. And guys, read John's book. That's you can also do. It's wonderfully sourced. Go ahead.
Thanks. Yeah. So, and you can find on Amazon, Rediscovering Republicanism. Very easy to find. So, but you type that in. Welfare case counts went down 60% over the next 3 years. Research was done later about, well, what was the cause of that? And there were people from the Brookings Institution, which I generally really respect their work. They're you know, you could argue they're a little left, but I think they're very, very fair-minded in their methodology. Okay. There was their most famous sort of social scientist was about 2/3 of it was related to the law, right? Because the economy was really good too. So there were some other variables you needed to account for. Mm-hmm. But here's the other thing that was really interesting. childhood poverty rates went down. Out of wedlock rates went down. Poverty rates overall went down. Poverty rates for children went down. Work participation rates went up. Income went up. Not even overall, for the people we're talking about.
Right.
So it's not like we're spending less money and blah, blah, and these people are taking care of themselves. And it's like, no, their lives are better. And you, and there were a lot of people who were very concerned about this that had to come out later and say, I was wrong. This was a really positive social reform.
Yeah.
And I think, Adam, I don't, you know, it's one of the issues I touch on a bit in the book, but I think is really important is, I think one of the negative things that we don't realize, and I really don't think people understand this, it's a subtle point, but I think really important. One of the downsides of these federal social welfare programs is there is an implicit, I don't say it's an argument or point, that the people you're helping can't help themselves.
Of course.
And it's really interesting because even left-wing people will do this. Because left-wing people think that they're really optimistic, and right-wing people are sort of presented as, oh, they're heartless.
Right.
But it's very interesting because what right-wing people say is, I really believe you can take care of yourself. I believe in you.
Yeah, they're right. Yeah.
And left-wing people say, I really care about you, but let's be honest. You're not going to amount to much. The minimum best we can do for you is at least give you some money so you can, like, you know, eat okay. Right. And you'd be shocked the number of people that I think that's kind of where they're coming from. Now, they say they want to help, but there's this like really undermining people's sense of self-actualization and self-determination. It's very insidious. And I think when the welfare reforms rolled out, I'm talking to someone who's actually read a lot of interviews from people who came out of the program. And they literally said, when the law came out, I was like, wait, I'm responsible for myself. Can I get out of bed? Can I get out of bed on time? Can I go get a job? Can I go show up on time? And most of them found they could, but they had literally stopped believing in themselves because we had stopped believing in them.
That's right.
And then when we passed the law and Bill Clinton's like, we believe in you. You can make a contribution. We need you. That's very meaningful. And I think we really sometimes really miss the mark on these programs. Like it's nice to give someone $1,000, but you're taking away their sense of purpose. You're taking away their sense of meaning. And everyone in our society can contribute. Everybody has something to contribute. It's just a matter of magnitude.
Again, you know, but all of that is true. And it's very interesting you make that distinction because, yes, in the purest sense, if you take out the ulterior motives and partisan agendas, right? The traditional conservative approach is there are limits because of human nature. You can't socially engineer it. Big institutions are doomed to fail because they ignore complexity. However, you as an individual, it's based on individual rights, have that autonomy and that agency. You're the author of your happiness and your selfhood, right? Totally. And it's interesting because you'll hear people say that psychological wisdom, if you will, on the left, but then they'd be the oh no, but we can't cut anything. I'm like, okay, well, your policies are behavior inducing. You can't separate that. And because we live in a country where public opinion and conformity is so strong on any issue, if you become the person that votes against the food stamp bill, even if the food stamp bill has nothing to do with food stamps or it really harms people, you're a monster. You're a bad guy. You know, how could you be against this? You know, listen, I was against the Anti-Inflation Act. It has nothing to do with inflation and it's full of a lot of garbage and lumps everything in together. And people came down hard on me and they're like, well, how could you be against this? I said, look, I voted for Joe Biden. I like Joe Biden. I'm a never Trumper first and foremost. I do believe the government required big scale intervention during COVID because it was a once in a century pandemic. But no, I don't believe we should spend another $3 trillion because the left flank of the party wants this, but the activists want. I don't think it's good government. It's not going to bring down inflation. It's not going to grow the economy. It's just going to be more lard. It is. And so I was against it. But so I mean, as I'm saying, I have a lot of sympathies here. And sending it back to the states is an important prognosis that you put, you argue, because, you know, you're not just saying get rid of it, right? You're not Darwin. Yeah. You know, and you're not, and you know, this isn't Victorian England. Like, sorry, love, you're on your own. You know, no, I mean, you said we have 50 governments because we essentially have 50 countries, and let each little self-contained state government do or attempt to try to do something because A, that's what they're there for, and B, they're closer to you.
Totally. I mean, I'll walk people through the conclusions of the book. So the problems were the complexity failure. I'll walk the other two. was windfall politics and the government surcharge. And I'll, you know, the complexity failure really relates to social welfare programs. I think it explains why those didn't work. Windfall politics kind of explains why Social Security and Medicare are insolvent. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is it mismanaging those programs has provided political windfalls for politicians for going on 90 years.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
like you said, I mean,
these kick the can down the road, right?
Kick the can down the road and get some votes along the way and, you know, whatever. And it sounds really great for the next 2 years, but not necessarily from an actuarial perspective. And then the government surcharge mm-hmm. is basically like, why do government services cost more? And you can see this over and over, Amtrak, Postal Service, et cetera, versus, you know, USPS, FedEx, where you go look at Europe and these privatized postal systems. And that, again, what's the root cause? And the root cause is very simple. Government employees get to help select their boss. That's all it is. I mean, period. You can stop the conversation right there. So if you look at like local labor, like local locomotive unions, I mean, take the Postal Service. The Postal Service, every single politician in the country knows that they have postal workers in their district. Everybody has. Like, so you want to talk about a group of people. It's like, do I really want to mess with them? Right. I don't want to make them change. I don't want to make them efficient. I mean, you walk into a postal, like why when you walk into a postal store, I mean, it's like, what? This is like the 1970s.
Oh, I know.
It doesn't update. Why am I getting stamps from a person? I mean, I'm sorry. I can buy a car from a tower, Carvana. Right.
Well, Yeah.
I'm buying cars from literally automation. I mean, you can go get stamp machines now, but guys, that took us like 20 freaking years to figure out. That's completely ridiculous. Why is that? Because the postal unions have a lot of power,
sure.
which is why we don't want the government to be providing services. We want the government to be funding services or right. giving us vouchers.
Right. Supervising things like discriminatory measures and things that 100%. Would be harmful.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
But we don't want them in the business of actually providing things because basically you're going to get the same thing at lower quality and a higher price. And there is almost no exception to that. You see it over and over and over again. So if you don't mind, I'll quickly, because I want to make sure the listeners have a sense of sure. Sense of the whole here.
Yeah.
So those are the problems. What's the recommendation? Right. So the high level recommendation is the smartest people who thought about politics in this country's history were the people who were involved in the beginning. Okay. Mm-hmm. We had the most talented because it was interesting, right? I mean, we're starting a country. So you got someone like Benjamin Franklin. I mean, if you read Benjamin Franklin's writing, it's like you think he's living today. I mean, he's
a republic if you can keep it.
A right. republic if you can keep it, right? I mean, right. super talented people, right? Not to besmirch.
And he was the eldest of the founder. But he was already much older at the time of the.
Yeah. Totally. And George Washington. I mean, these guys are completely incredible people, right? They really thought this through. So I think the overarching thing is, let's really understand what they believed about human nature, about politics, because I think they have more insight on the topic than the people who are running our system today. The specifics are, I think social welfare programs, we need to be pushing as much as we can to the state governments, the 10th Amendment, et cetera, social welfare programs, education, it should all be back in the states. Not because it's not important, because it's too important.
Right.
Because conservatives are always like, we shouldn't be spending money on that. That's a terrible argument. No, we should be spending money on that. But we shouldn't be spending on that money here. We should be spending the money back where you guys live, where you can actually get your hands on the people who are making these decisions. Second thing, retirement programs. Mm-hmm. They're completely mismanaged, right? Social Security, Medicare, completely mismanaged. We all know that. They're going insolvent. Okay. We can kick the can down the road and continue to raise taxes like we've done for 80 years. Or we can just say, look, we can look at England. We can look at Sweden. Sweden, right? Everyone knows, have created private accounts. Mm-hmm. So that people like you and me, and I'm sure the vast majority of your listeners that can handle your own basic finances, let you take care of yourself. If it doesn't work out, we have a social safety net. No one above 70 years old should be in poverty. No one above 70 years old shouldn't have access to healthcare, right? We have enough money that maybe we should just say that that's a guarantee. But if you can take care of yourself, let's give people that right. I mean, we're Americans. Give people the chance to take
care of yourself. It's important to know that Chile and Sweden, you know, and that I was referencing Scandinavian countries. Yeah.
That is not a right-wing country. They have private accounts now. That is the future. I think America should catch up. Right. The way we're running this is totally crazy. We all know Social Security is BS. Everybody knows that. It's a terrible program. It gets negative. It's like, I mean, what other thing is going to hold your money for 40 years and give you negative 1% return?
Right.
I mean, guys, this is nuts. Okay. So what I'm saying in the book is wake up, smell the bad news, mm-hmm. and let's figure out a way to get to the future. Right. Because this is not it. And then the third thing that I talk about that I think that was really important to the founders is we have to get Americans away from, and you said it so well at the beginning of this episode, every time we have a problem, we have to pass a law. Mm. We've got to get rid of that impulse. It's like, guys, it's like your crazy Uncle Ned. It's like, you know what? He thinks he can do everything, but he's like, yeah, I'll do Thanksgiving. And he comes in and the turkey's burnt. Or he's like, I'll take the kids out for an afternoon. And then you come outside and he's just like, they're like walking around by themselves. Uncle Ned, he's a really well-intentioned guy, but he's completely incompetent. Okay. Well,
he's the guy at the end of the bars shouting out dogma, drinking. You know, that guy said, I could fix this. You know,
totally. You're right. Exactly. And we've had enough of Uncle Ned that we need to grow up and say, Uncle Ned is a really great guy. We all love Uncle Ned, but he's not going to do anything that he says. And so the third thing I basically says is we have to take some of these problems on ourselves. Right. And you look at space travel, you look at solving, you know, you look at the COVID vaccines. Who's doing this cool stuff? I mean, really, I mean, take space travel. I mean, really, if even me, I would probably say, well, you probably need the government to figure out space travel. I literally, that would be my intuition.
Right.
No. We have a private company, SpaceX, that NASA has spent, I think, over $40 billion, by the way, on a program to try to get us to Mars. They haven't even created a rocket yet. SpaceX has already got the Falcon 9 or whatever it is that's basically good to go. And so now the federal government is contracting with a private company to get the human civilization to Mars. So take a pause, humans, Americans, and just think about this. And the conclusion is we, the people, both individual and as groups and institutions and nonprofits and universities, we have to take these problems on ourselves. The federal government is just not going to do it. They say they are. The evidence is so slim. At some point, you just got to, it's really convenient to believe that they're going to be effective, but at some point you just got to grow up.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm really thankful for your summation. I would say, and before we go, cause that was great. You really outlined it. And, yes, everybody needs to read Rediscovering Republicanism, Renewing America with Our Founding Vision and Values, John Nantz, N-A-N-T-Z. Thank you. But before we go, two things, I want to just say, leave listeners with this. We glossed over it. Allegedly, I guess this could be said, this is, you know, apocryphal, but some version of it. Benjamin Franklin was walking out of the Constitutional Convention, and they always say it was a lady, but a person, you know, said, what are you guys all doing in there? And he said, making a republic if you can keep it, you know, and he was doubtful because this is important. The founders didn't create a direct democracy, people, because guess what? I know you're not going to want to hear this. They didn't trust you to do the right thing. The House was the people's house, the inflamed passions. You see that with the chaos now. And the Senate, though not directly elected by people till the 20th century, was meant to temper that. And the government was meant to operate slowly, right? And to frustrate things, which is why when you rely, you want government to barrel forward and control your life, it crashes against a system that's not designed to do that. That's really an inherent tension. All right. So a republic, if you can keep it, because they were making a Republican form of government, not the current. We're talking about the Donald Trump Republican. We're talking about, he's not even a Republican. We're talking about a republic if you can keep it. And that's very important. And it's why I think John's book is getting at, if you can keep it. We've gone so far afield here that we aren't even asking questions. We're just spending and passing laws. P.J. O'Rourke, the great satirist who recently died, a great humorist, a conservative. I'll leave you guys with this. He said, Republicans complain, big R Republicans, that the government doesn't work. Then they get elected and prove it. Anyway, that's a good one. Well, John, listen, thank you so much for being on Dirty Moderate. Come back and see us anytime with your follow-up to this book, which I can't wait to read. But in the meantime, folks, read Rediscovering Republicanism. Check him out. I think it's an important book. I think it's a blueprint of sorts, and I hope everybody sees it as such. So, again, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks for being a good citizen.
My pleasure. Thanks, Adam. Yeah.